The equally corrosive repression of his supporters has revealed a national political culture plagued by self-righteousness, anger, and violence. An extensive recent survey found that nearly a third of Americans believe that political violence is usually or always justified.
So I think the violence already is happening. I think it's the question of, you know, as we get closer to 2024, that violence is going to get turned up a dial. So I think it's really, it's sad, unfortunate, it's terrible, but I think it's a consequence of, you know, what the ruling class has actually, you know, fomented.
The poll was taken shortly after the in-home attack on the husband of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Many are shocked that the nation's vast and armed-to-the-teeth security services couldn't adequately protect the home of the nation's number three post. The incident continues to be the subject of salacious allegations, which have been exacerbated by the Pelosi's refusal to release their home security footage, as well as the refusal of local police to release their own body camera footage. The suppression of news reports on the incident has further inflamed public opinion. Polls repeatedly show that Nancy Pelosi has the lowest approval ratings of any prominent member of Congress. Pelosi's have been recently accused of insider trading, and the extremely wealthy family is often criticized for flaunting their affluence. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Pereza, London.
An Islamophobia scandal now threatens a British student union following anger over the sacking of its female Muslim president amid allegations of anti-Semitism. Shaima Dilali was elected president of the National Union of Students in March. Dilali was initially hailed for being the first ever black Muslim female to take up the post. However, she was suspended from the role in July amid an investigation into anti-Israel comments she made up to 10 years prior to her election, including a 2012 tweet in which Ms. Dilali wrote, "Khayber, Khayber, O Jews, Mohammed's army will return to Gaza," a tweet she has since apologized for. An NUS statement on the decision said,
"Following the independent King's College-led investigation into allegations of anti-Semitism, specifically into the then president-elect under the NUS Code of Conduct, an independent panel has found that significant breaches of NUS's policies have taken place. As per this finding, we have terminated the president's contract."
Dilali expressed further fury at the news of her sacking after she discovered it on Twitter, shared by a pro-Israel newspaper who may have been leaked the story prior to the NUS updating Mrs. Dilali. In response, Dilali has vowed to fight the outcome via a pending legal challenge alleging discriminatory treatment. Mrs. Dilali's sacking has sparked furious anger across the British Muslim community, who believe this is gross censorship of pro-Palestine activism.
Anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is like comparing apples and oranges. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Jewish faith. Actually, it's the weaponization of the Jewish faith that we are seeing. What we are talking is a colonization enterprise. That is the whole existence of the Israeli regime is a colonization enterprise. It's clear that the whole issue is to criminalize pro-Palestinian sentiment, which actually shows you how effective pro-Palestinian sentiment is.
Things could get very ugly for the NUS as Muslim student bodies are threatening a boycott and Dilali plans her fight back. The NUS has previously prided itself on being an inclusive environment for all and an advocate of free speech. However, they now have to prove that that is indeed the case amid racism and Islamophobia accusations thrown their way by the former president, Robert Carter, London.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of a slain journalist should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been inspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddousi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten or ignored. We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists like Press TV's martyrs who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, Employers Association Confindustria, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency ISTAT has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Milk, bread, pasta, all these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni traveled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shahbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts. If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized, and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international condemnations.
The attack on the former Pakistani prime minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Political violence in the U.S. has reached epic proportions due to the polarization in the country. One example, the U.S. President Joe Biden has accused his predecessor Donald Trump and his supporters of undermining democracy ahead of next week's midterm elections. Some Republican candidates have said that they may refuse to accept the outcome should they lose. This comes on top of the most recent act of violence against the husband of the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who was attacked with a hammer. How have U.S. politics reached a point where politicians are threatening each other and Americans are acting out violently?
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joins us from Austin, New York. Also joining us is journalist and author Daniel Lazar, also joining us from New York. Okay, welcome to you both. So we are continuing this U.S. political violence theme in another episode of our program, and we deemed it to be that important, and I mentioned that in the last time we had that to both of you, because there were some revelations that were unprecedented in a sense, which is not associated in the mainstream outside of the U.S. perhaps, in terms of the depth of what this really means. So we had this attack, Daniel Lazar, first start with you, where you had Nancy Pelosi's husband, and I remember last time I made a mistake saying axe. Anyways, he was hit with a hammer. But the person who was looking for her, for the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of which he said that he would injure her. Now the question comes about: is this just a lone incident of somebody, an American, acting out in this form and manner, which is obviously very violent?
Well, it's hard to say, but it's definitely, there's no question that tempers are rising, that tensions are increasing. There is a huge degree of polarization. People are very angry, and there's a great deal of, you know, talk of violence in the air. I mean, after all, on January 6, 2021, we had a mob invade Washington. Four or five people were killed. The mob, you know, members of the mob chanted, you know, where is Nancy? Where is Nancy? Nancy Pelosi is a polarizing figure. And they engaged in a great deal of destruction and would likely have killed Nancy Pelosi if they'd gotten their hands on her. Probably is the same thing true for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others. So, you know, there's a real danger of violence because the machinery of government is breaking down, and as it breaks down, anger and frustration are increasing on all sides.
Don DeBar, isn't it a far cry, though, to have people, average Americans, in a matter of speaking, act out against politicians in a way? Well, I guess they mentioned the January 6th incident that happened there on Capitol Hill. For them to come out and want to kill their lawmakers, the U.S. politicians, how should one view that?
Well, let's look at it through the prism of the editorial pages of the New York Times in July 2018, where after Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin to try to calm relations between the two countries, accused Trump of treason, and there were calls for him to be prosecuted for that, which, by the way, carries the death penalty. Let's start there. This is something that's been tracked. At Pew Research, for example, did a study in 2014 looking at the period from 1994 to 2014 and shows the entrenchment of this polarization where large chunks of people on the left and right, quote unquote, these terms are really kind of meaningless right now, but the liberal and conservative are the terms they used in their study. Of the Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, how the number of Democrats that identified as liberal and Republicans that identified as conservatives had grown and hardened. The phenomenon really didn't begin in 1994. It began much earlier, of course. I remember the presidential election in 1980, for example. At the time, however, Democrats that identified as liberals were, among other things, anti-war, for example. One of the big fears of Reagan being elected in 1980 was that he would start a war with the Soviet Union. Here we are with someone who everyone calls in the political economy here a liberal, Joe Biden, is actually at war with Russia. You know, there's a lot of stuff to really sort of plod through here. There's just one last point, because I want clarity on this from the last conversation that we had. You know, Dan correctly referred to the fact that there is this other process where there's a block, basically if the vote from each state at the joint session in January 6th is rejected, then the electors are chosen by a different mechanism than, you know, than, in other words, not voted on by the House members, but rather by people that are selected to do that job. As a matter of fact, you would never get there because you would first have votes in each of the two chambers on the challenges, and in each of those cases, those votes would be conducted in houses of Congress that had Democratic majorities on January 6, 2021. So the idea that somehow that insurrection was tied to a strategy for a coup d'etat, really, it just falls.
Okay, very well. Let's look at how long this has been going on, this term, political violence, and of course the way that it has now really brought into the fore, Daniel Lazar. I mean, I went back as far as Abe Lincoln and the assassination that happened there, of which the person that did it said, I did what I thought was best. And then you had some periodicals that wrote that the Almighty God has ordered this event. And I mentioned that in terms of the periodicals, and I want to kind of compare that to, or make a note of what our guest there, Dan DeBar, said that the New York Times, as a media or a print media, is also lending a hand in the way that things become polarized by drawing that type of analysis. So are we looking as that as being something that has happened from way before and is just continued throughout the decades in the U.S.?
Well, not quite. I mean, first of all, the Lincoln was assassinated at the very end of a civil war which claimed 600,000 lives in a country at the time had that population about 24 million. So, you know, it was a bloody, bloody war, a huge war, and it culminated with the assassination of the leader of the Union forces. But after that, you know, things died down. There was, you know, there was little, you know, little of that sort of thing in Washington. But beginning in the 1960s, 1968, we saw a series of assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. We saw the assassination of JFK in 63. But there's no doubt that passions have been heating up since the 1990s in a new way. The machinery of government is breaking down. We have had gridlock, an absolute deadlock in Congress for 30 years or so. Nothing can get done, and the less that gets done, the more frustrations rise on either side, and the more poisonous the atmosphere
becomes.
Give
us an example.
Well, you know, I mean, Newt Gingrich shut down the government on two different occasions. They impeached Bill Clinton for the crime of having a sexual, you know, engagement with one of with a White House aide. You know, each of these things, you know, sort of raised tempers to new levels. And there was no way of resolving these things because the angrier Republicans got, then the angrier Democrats got, and the more Congress stopped working. Uh-huh. The American government is based on this bizarre 18th century system of checks and balances. Basically, you have to have three or even four major institutions agree before anything can get done. That's the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. And if one of each of those bodies has veto power. So what you found starting in the mid-90s was that the that Congress and the presidency were vetoing one another constantly, and nothing happened, nothing got done. And the more of a stalemate you had, the angrier people got. And then the angrier they got, the more they dug their heels in.
I see.
You know, so the process is kind of self-fueling. And so tempers are now shooting upwards. We'll see what happens on the election on Tuesday. But I think that there's no doubt that the basic governmental functions in the U.S. are hanging in the balance. And American democracy, such as it is facing a major crisis. I mean, I rarely agree with Joe Biden about anything, but in this case, he is correct. The country is facing a major structural crisis.
Well, Don DeBar, since our guest there mentioned the midterms, looking at what the latest is on Joe Biden, who has obviously made a point to call upon the midterms and says, basically saying that, you know, this is something that is chipping away at the U.S. democracy and that, you know, we can't, this shouldn't be happening. Why is the midterms going to be a reflection of this in the sense that Joe Biden is painting that picture? Do you agree with him?
He has to paint that picture. First of all, look at Biden's own numbers. His numbers are the lowest for any sitting president since the day before Nixon resigned. That's a fact, and it's been that way for a good while now. He needs some sort of a distraction, or they're going to lose both houses, and he may well be impeached. That's a fact also. Let's start with JFK, who was assassinated in November 1963, Malcolm X, who was assassinated in February 1965, Martin Luther King in April of 1968, Robert Kennedy in June of 1968. In each case, security forces inside the United States have at least been implicated if they have not been held responsible. Okay, if we look further, if you want to talk about political violence, hold the picture of Muammar Gaddafi after he was run with a spear or a gun with a knife on it, whatever you call it, a bayonet. And the words, we came, they saw, he died. That's out of Hillary Clinton's mouth. I don't know how anyone could be sanctimonious about political violence when that's their team. Mm-hmm. This is something, again, and you asked, I missed it, because when we talk at the same time over these, you know, media, I can't hear when you, et cetera. You asked when... H.R.A.P. Brown said that violence is as American as apple pie. And it was in 1967. So that's in the midst of the assassinations that I just ran. You know, we've seen political assassinations all the way up to an attempt today where they tried to kill Imran Khan. I'm guessing if you find a dirty hand there, if the assassin, the attempted assassin, actually the assassin, because he did kill some other people, if they actually get him to trial, you may find out that the U.S. had a hand in that. Or look at Dugina, whatever her name is, Dugin's daughter. Uh-huh. That assassination. Certainly the U.S. or the U.K., the Ukrainians, et cetera, had a hand in that. This is political violence. This is real political violence. The attempts on Castro's life, over the course of his time in office in Cuba, the attempts on Nicolas Maduro's life. I mean, this is U.S. policy. Sure. Why suddenly is a guy with horns a major threat to the U.S. democracy? I don't understand it. It's so absurd.
It is. Now we're talking about the international arena and how the U.S. acts regarding that. But we're focusing on the U.S. here, so we have to go with that line for this program.
Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were domestic, and so were the two Kennedys.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay. To expand further on what Joe Biden said there, Daniel Lazar, which is what we're getting at here in some sense, or what I'm trying to get at from you, is the fact that political violence, according to the U.S. Biden, U.S. President Joe Biden, he has said that it is undermining democracy. And he says, make no mistake, democracy is on the ballot for all of us. Do you agree with him?
I do, actually, yes. I mean, first of all, let me say that Don is correct. I mean, the U.S. has pursued violent policies abroad, for decades. And the assassination of Qasem Soleimani is just merely one example of U.S. policy. But the U.S. domestically has been kind of sort of a democracy all this period, and that matters too. People can speak their mind. I can write whatever I want to without worrying about police breaking down my door. And elections have been, in general, kind of decided in a fair and democratic manner. But that is breaking down dramatically. Joe Biden's speech was classic Joe Biden. Joe Biden doesn't admit that the American system, as it presently exists, is falling apart before our very eyes. So it isn't that the Republicans are doing this single-handedly. The Republicans are merely acting in response to what is plainly a systemic collapse. American political institutions are 235 years old. They have never been subject to a fundamental overhaul. The system is so old, so out of date, so unresponsive to the needs of modern society, it's not funny. And yet the system is so frozen that any kind of reform is impossible. So we have an electoral college, a Senate which is unrepresentative. We have a Senate which is grossly unrepresentative. In the Senate, a majority of the population lives in just 10 states that are outvoted by the minority in the other 40. In the House, which is supposedly more democratic, Republicans have enjoyed a 12 or 14% advantage since 2010. And now in the Supreme Court, Republicans have an unbreakable 6-3 majority. And that majority will persist for probably another decade. They have got a free hand to do whatever they want with American society, and the Democratic majority is powerless. So Americans live under a minority dictatorship. And that dictatorship is growing.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Americans living under a dictatorship. Well, Don DeBar, based on what Daniel Lazar there said, are we looking at a solution which is far-fetched, but then again is something that could be put out there, and that is a reform, which I think Daniel Lazar said a reform is not even possible at this point, that you need an overhaul, I guess, of the whole system, so to speak. I mean, is that something that... But is that feasible? Is that realistic to look at it that way? And is that a cause of what we call one of the outcomes being a political violence that has been part of U.S. politics and mainstream the mainstream average Joe on the streets there in the U.S.?
At first, I'll agree in part with what Daniel just said about there being a systemic problem. Some evidence of that. I did a Google search for illegitimate president and qualified it before 12/31/2019. Hillary Clinton, here's a headline from the Independent in the UK. Hillary Clinton says Trump knows he's an illegitimate president. There's quotes and such. Former President Jimmy Carter says Trump is an illegitimate president. That's from Vox and NBC News. He lost, this is a quote, he lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf. You know, this has been going on certainly since the 2016 election in depth. And let's not forget that there were mobs. There's no, you know, if what was outside the Capitol was a mob on January 6th, 2021, there were mobs on Inauguration Day in 2017 and lots of other occasions like during the Supreme Court appointments of Kavanaugh and others. This is something that I agree that there's a breakdown here. What I don't agree is that the solution is going to be somehow to redo the Constitution because it's 235 years old, because the first question that arises is who exactly is going to be in charge of that process? Because the real problem is that there is power that is much greater than the construct of that 235-year-old Constitution that sits on top of an empire around the world. And that is who would be handling the rewrite of the U.S. Constitution. And my guess is that the first target would be the Bill of Rights. And so, you know, we have some serious structural problems. The structural problems that we have is we have the largest military in the world. That's a bipartisan effort. You know, I don't know how you vote for democracy in the face of that when each party does nothing but increase the military budget and the reach of the military across the planet every time they're voted in. That's the problem that we have. I think our structural problems are a lot deeper than the old documents.
Sure. Well, the problems are so deep that there's not many, but there are some publications out there, Daniel Lazar, that there's been talk about dividing the U.S. along the red and blue states. I mean, there's even been talks of that. So is that how deep this problem of political violence is, that it needs to go in that direction? I mean, we've heard about that. There's even been states that have said that they want to separate themselves from the U.S. But then overall, what about that approach? What's your thoughts on that?
I don't think that approach will work. I mean, that's a neo.
Not that it works, but what do you think about the fact that it went there?
I think it shows how polarized things are, and how the country is splitting up geographically as well as ideologically. There's no doubt about that. But listen, you have a 235-year-old system, and the idea that you can't touch this, that it is not subject to a democratic overhaul, is ridiculous. I mean, how much longer can people put up with this? Another 200 years? I mean, you know, would you want the same government in Iran that you had in the late 18th century? Does Russia want to go back to the age of Catherine the Great? Does France want to go back to the age of Louis the 16th? This is, you know, the American government actually dates from the final years of Louis the 16th. And it has not changed fundamentally since. Uh-huh. This is a complete absurdity that people don't realize, even Americans don't realize, how profoundly conservative and backward their political system is. Okay. It's remarkable.
Well, the political violence has reached proportions that could be called epic, Don DeBar, if you agree or not. But there's also been this coverage that some are saying may result in a civil war, that the political violence, because of a surge, a civil war is not so out of reach, and that is exaggerated. Is it?
I think a civil war is being stoked, certainly. I don't think that the contradictions that exist materially in the United States actually lead to one. There are some astroturfed ideological differences that induce that kind of polarization. I mean, this has been the tradecraft of the CIA around the world. Look at all of Latin America. Even look at the attempted color revolution in Iran recently and the things that happen around the world like this. They go in, they have a media that divides the population, and they fight over things that are insignificant, but a major policy is made behind the scenes. And,
okay.
You know, the fact that I don't understand what the process would be,
sure.
The democratic process would be in the United States to amend the Constitution, because I don't understand what democratic institution would conduct it.
Very well. I'm sorry. I got to jump in because we're just out of time here. Don DeBar, I do apologize. I'm sorry. We're just out of time. Activist and commentator Don DeBar, there, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you so much for your contribution.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini left Tehran for the holy city of Qom 3 weeks after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He stayed in Qom nearly for 10 months. During this period, people would come to visit the Imam from all over the country. However, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution had to return to Tehran due to heart problem. Today, we will continue the story. Stay tuned, please. it was said before, Imam Khomeini had to go up the steps to the roof of his house in Qom as people would gather in the alley to visit him. The Imam used to do this several times every day. Thus, he would get tired and his heart would be under pressure. Moreover, Imam Khomeini would receive a number of officials every day. This magnitude of work soon caused him heart problem in early 1980. One day his wife, Ms. Saghafi, noticed a severe pain in the Imam's shoulder and left hand, so she soon informed Haj Ahmad of the event. The Imam's special physician, Dr. Baher, asked for checking up his heart by a heart specialist. Ms. Faride Mustafavi, the Imam's daughter, relates the story. Dr. Baher came to visit the Imam. After checking him, he said that the Imam's heart should be checked up by a specialist. Then he immediately telephoned Tehran and a medical team was sent to Qom. When I went to the Imam's residence, I saw that Dr. Zargar, then Minister of Health, was there with a few people. Medical checkup was done and the physicians came to the conclusion that the Imam should be checked up for a few days. Therefore, the next day, the Imam was sent to Tehran in an ambulance and was hospitalized at Tehran's Heart Hospital. The day after, my mother came to Tehran and went to his father's house. Then he went to the Imam at the hospital. The news of Imam Khomeini's hospitalization spread across the country in a few minutes. Thus, a big crowd of people gathered in the streets around the hospital. The medical team asked the people to pray for the Imam's health and immediate healing. People gradually left the area as they had become sure of his health. But the enemies spread rumors on Imam Khomeini's demise or his suffering from an incurable disease. Meanwhile, in spite of the physician's recommendation on absolute resting, the Imam delivered a very short speech, which was televised and broadcast on TV. This short speech ended all rumors of enemies. Fortunately, Imam Khomeini gained his health with the efforts of doctors and the prayers of people and left the hospital. The medical team said that the Imam should reside near the Heart Hospital to be under surveillance. Imam Khomeini accepted the recommendation, although he liked to return to Qom. Therefore, a house was determined in Darabad neighborhood of Tehran, but due to people's frequent commutation and the medical team's presence, there were disturbances for inhabitants of the place. Thus, another place was proposed for the Imam's residence. Haj Ahmad and the daughters of Imam Khomeini saw the house and accepted it as it was adjacent to a Hosseiniye, which was a suitable place for public meetings. The Hosseiniye was called Hosseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the household furniture was transferred to the new house. Hosseiniye Jamaran was half-built and it was full of construction materials, but it was completed with the people's effort within 4 days. In mid-May 1980, people decorated the street to welcome the Imam. Imam Khomeini came at 7 p.m., while a big number of people had gathered there. After entering the house and looking at the rooms, the Imam said, "Now I am comfortable, as I was under pressure for 4 months." The new house was small, but the imam liked it. At 8 o'clock, the imam said that he was ready to meet the people around the house. Therefore, the first public meeting was held at Hosseinie Jamaran. A few days later, the VOA said that after a few months of searching, a place had been determined for Ayatollah Khomeini, which is immune against any air raid. The next examinations revealed that the imam's residence was suitable in terms of security, as it was beside mountains and surrounded among tall trees. Although the imam's wife would complain about the size of the rooms, the imam told her, "This is a good house. Those who come here will know that this is your house."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.